Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Tech Days Online, Day 2, DevOps. I'm Marcus Robinson, a technical evangelist at Microsoft here in the UK. With me on the sofa have Danny Crone from Enfocus. Now, just before we get started, if anybody does have any questions or comments about what we're doing today, please do send us a tweet with the hashtag Tech Days. Hashtag Tech Days. Okay, Danny, over to you.
So, thank you very much for that, Marcus. It's nice to be here. It's an interesting idea to be talking about testing and automated testing within DevOps. Often it's mentioned, but it isn't actually gone into in any great detail. And actually, I think it's a really important part. So the talk is about supporting DevOps through automated testing. It's not just about automating tests. People often get this a little bit confused. Now, I think the one question that bothers me is how do we convince, or why is it so difficult to convince some senior decision makers and stakeholders of the value of automated testing? And I've thought about this a lot. I've been in IT. I've been an IT consultant and a test professional for over 20 years. And what I've seen is that often organizations try and employ some automation, but it doesn't quite meet expectations. It falls short in some ways, and that means that actually they've had a bad experience, and so they don't really trust it. So the question is, how do we change that perception, and what is it that we should be doing? So I think we need to take a long, hard look at ourselves as a test community, really, and take on that responsibility for changing some of those perceptions. Now, as we know, DevOps is about collaboration and communication between software professionals, software developers, but also about automating that delivery process. And certainly, it's supposed to foster an environment where developers and testers and infrastructure can get together, but also that they can release software faster, getting things out to live as quickly as possible. So, if testing takes a long time, why shouldn't we just automate that, make it quicker, and Bob's your uncle?
Makes sense to me, but you're going to tell me maybe not?
Well, the thing is, we need to think about this long and hard, and I think that I think it's about architecting the automation right. Now, I've thought a lot about using this word architect. I could use the word design, but I don't think that gives it enough. I actually think that we need to get the fundamentals right. So we need to be looking at what we're trying to achieve when we're automating tests. And today we're going to look at that, and we're going to look at the release pipeline and the environments that the release pipeline flow through, how we should choose what things to automate, and probably very importantly, about the reliability of those tests and bringing trust levels up. And through those that pipeline and those different environments, what about the test data that we should be using there? So. So here's the bottom line. The development team want faster releases, but the ops team wants stability and reliability. And guess what? The business wants both. So if we can automate testing again and we can make things run faster, why shouldn't we be the golden boys? Why shouldn't we be the heroes and produce this automation? Well, first of all, we have to explore what are the advantages of automated testing, and these might be well known, but some of them not so clear. Automation gives us an early indication of quality. Being able to highlight regressions at the end of each build is just going to allow us to respond quicker to those failures and actually stop those bugs getting into the process in the first place.
We want to get that as soon as possible.
I mean, everybody wants that feedback loop to be really tight, right? And we should be helping that as testers. Time to market. This is absolutely essential for getting competitive advantage. So quicker regression testing will reduce those that time to market and allow them to get that competitive advantage. Write once and run everywhere. In the different environments that we'll see in the pipeline in a minute, you know, different data is required at different stages, and so we should be designing and architecting our test automation to be able to consider all of those different variances. Excuse me. Accurate validation. Now, a human being, if they have to run a particular test 10 times over the course of a number of sprints, then you can guarantee that the 10th time they look at that test, they won't be paying as much attention to the screen as they were on the first time. A robot, however, makes no distinction. It will always use the same level of detail. There is a caveat here, which is that the robot won't catch things that you don't ask it to catch. So actually, the human eye, what I'm not advocating here is that we don't do any manual testing. That's not the case. But it does save the human beings from that monotony. Validating difficult scenarios, some scenarios like performance testing, non-functional type testing, can only be done by using certain types of software. And performance testing is a good example of that. Getting 1,000 people to hit the submit button all at the same time is just not an option. Clean architecture, it helps to promote a clean architecture. And that's dependent on whether you're working in legacy systems or whether you're actually looking at greenfield sites. Greenfield sites, it's easier to do that. Legacy systems, actually, I've seen that the implementation of automation helps people start to think about how could we re-architect this to make it more testable and produce a cleaner architecture. And it makes things a lot easier to get some idea of product or code coverage. We can start using tools whilst automation is running to get an understanding of what code paths we're actually going down whilst we're exercising those tests. A lot more difficult if you're doing manual tests. So we know that actually, you know, we should be doing some automation. There's some great reasons for doing automated tests in the pipeline. Why don't we just go get a Selenium guy or gal and get cracking, get doing it? Well, again, I think we need to think very, very carefully, and we need to look at. And again, there's differences here between legacy and greenfield, starting from new. But what are the coverage of those tests going to be? How long do they take to run? Where do they need to run? How will they be coordinated? And how successful and reliable are they? There's a lot of things to consider in all of that as to, well, where am I going to put test agents? What's my environment going to look like when we've put some agents around that environment? And how should they be accessing that environment? And how do we coordinate them to actually run tests? So let's take a look at the deployment pipeline. In order to get continuous deployment working, it all has to start with with CI, really, and this is certainly my view on the world. And a developer will check in a line of code. They'll commit that to the repository, and that repository should then kick off some kind of compilation. You can run some unit tests there, and I think that unit tests are important. Package that up and update the results. And that's the responsibility of a build agent, but we should be getting that feedback back to the developer as quick as possible. And also try and update something like TFS or VSTS to give some meaningful reports and stats to be able to see that information quickly in terms of build health. And I'm sure you've got experience of seeing some of those build reports.
Yeah, well, I know when if I commit code in Visual Studio, and it goes off to VSTS, starts an automated build. You know, I can then have a pane in Visual Studio that shows me the progress of that build and whether it's passed or failed, so I know very quickly.
Very quickly. And for me, unit testing, CI, first of all, is a necessity. It's not a luxury. Unit tests are definitely at a minimum. You can include functional tests here. And when I say functional tests, I'm thinking of tests above the glass. So not unit tests, something more than that, above the glass, possibly even UI. They are longer running tests, but we need to be really careful to keep them into a very short window, because we don't need this CI taking a long time to give that feedback information. But it's okay to put one or two in there. We need tools. We need tools like TFS, and we need compilers like MS Build. And there are other tools out there. And Microsoft's pretty good at allowing a multitude of these things to be involved in the release pipeline. And for testing, we need some unit testing tools: NUnit, MS Test, JUnit, that sort of thing. So, in the release pipeline, what we start to see is that we start to move along from something like system testing or a system testing environment to a system integration test environment. And the size of these environments might be different. You might have only a single machine in system test, whereas in system integration test, you might be starting to split the roles of those machines and actually have a web server and a database box, and those sorts of things are split out into multiple machines.
So we start to scale out the solution?
Starting to scale out the solution, but also the integration points. So you may be mocking some of those, but you may be connecting to third-party test systems as well, so web services that your core solution needs to call out to. But then you move on to pre-prod, and we're starting to look like an almost like-for-like representation of live. And it's clear once you start integrating with different end third-party solutions that the data that you use with your tests is going to have to be different. And this is where I'm talking about consideration for test data across multiple types of environments is really important, because one test that runs down in system testing might not run down in pre-prod. But also equally, there are things in pre-prod, like, for example, performance testing that can be run there, that actually you can get some benefit from running a smaller subset of earlier on, but actually you get the real benefit from using cloud load testing further down the line. So the next steps are really to look at that continuous deployment and how we actually go about that. And like I say, these environments might be scaled differently, but we need to move across each section of the pipeline. And as we move across each section of the pipeline, maybe a different subset of tests are actually executed. Certainly different data is going to be used across those. But what we also need is a feedback in terms of, can we move from system test to system integration test? Do we have the information from the tests that executed that tell us, yes, this is okay to actually move forwards? So in this, we need something like a workflow manager. We need something like release manager within VSTS or TFS. There are other tools out there, but I'm going to be looking a little bit later and looking at a demo on release manager. The things that we need to consider, and certainly as testers, this is all kind of new, is how do we provision those test agents? We need to either talk to somebody to explain what kind of test agents we need, or we need to implement that ourselves. How do we actually orchestrate or execute the tests? And what are the gates that let us in and out of those different environments?
So would you say, if we're running some tests at an early stage of the pipeline, do we need to rerun those tests later on the pipeline to verify the environment still complies?
Absolutely, and if you've got collateral like that, and so long as they're reliable tests and they're not too noisy, then it's definitely always worthwhile re-executing those tests. The one caveat there is it going to be using the same data? Obviously, we need a mechanism for ensuring that we can flip between different types of data. So what I'm going to do at this point is go take a look at Release Manager and a situation that I've set up in advance.
Great.
So let me just fire up, first of all, Visual Studio. And what we have here in Visual Studio is a solution with three projects. We've got a data project, we've got a desktop application project, and we've got a test project. Now, the test project has got some test cases in there. It just so happens to be that they are built using White, so they're using an open source automation tool for driving Windows Forms apps.
So what was that tool called again?
It's called White.
White.
Yeah, it's open source, and actually there's a lot more people starting to use this for Windows Forms applications. Excuse me. I think that I've been involved in quite a few different projects recently, but I'll say this: there's a commonality between all of them, which is I'm getting involved in a lot more legacy applications. You know, we like to think about working with the newest, the latest, and the greatest, but so often now I'm being asked to work with WPF applications or Windows Forms applications. And we need to find ways of being able to build that into our release pipeline. They want to get involved in the continuous deployment, but there's this massive backlog of manual tests that haven't been automated, so we need to get through those.
So if we want to introduce DevOps into our sort of release pipeline, we don't have to re-architect our software. We can still go and do this with legacy applications.
Absolutely. There is obviously unit tests might be, depending on the architecture, unit testing might be very difficult, but certainly above the glass functional UI automated tests will certainly work, although they are more brittle. But this is what I'm demonstrating here is some test cases that are above the glass. So I'll just show you that project briefly, and then we'll go into VSTS. And first of all, I'll start with the test hub, which is where I spend most of my time and organize a lot of the testing efforts. A lot of people kind of miss this point, but actually, in terms of the feedback, it's really useful to organize your tests in a way that you can understand and comprehend them. So I have three suites here within this master test plan, a master regression test plan. And in each of those, I have a test case that executes a bit of that functionality. This regression plan should get bigger and bigger over time, whilst sprint plans might stay relatively small and concentrate on the bit of functionality that's being implemented in that sprint. The regression plan is going to take consideration of all of the tests that need to be run each time you want to release the product. So we have a test plan here, and of course what that allows us to do is to be able to report on that in the dashboard and be able to have charts and reports that actually show us, well, here we've got the current sprint two, the test plan there, three test cases that have not been executed. The master plan, which actually at this stage only has three test cases, but also actually breaking that master plan down into the functional areas and see how green or red those functional areas are. So the next piece to look at is build, and I'm not going to go into this in any detail because I know Tarun went through this in his earlier session. But we have a straightforward CI build that every time we check in is going to kick off. And we also have a release pipeline, one here that I've called the main pipeline, that's defined. And if I edit that, we'll see a couple of environments here. And what I wanted to try and show here is that we do have a flow that moves from one environment to the next. We can also see that the triggers here, that this is a continuous deployment that's actually triggered on a successful build out of the build that I created in VSTS. What we see is a sequence of tasks here, and I'll go into those in a moment. But also on this system integration one here, what we can actually do is assign approvers, and what we have here is that actually, we can say that we aren't going to move into system integration test until somebody has put their eyes over some test results and is happy to sanction that moving. So this is the quality gate, really. So what I'm trying to do is bring to life here the fact that there are quality gates that are built in, but we need human beings to get involved in that. So when we get down to the actual tasks, and again, Tarun went through quite a few of these, but the first I've got is starting up an environment in Azure. So I've got a start action, and then we move on to a file copy. Now I'm doing a very simple deploy here, so my deployment step is really just simply copying the executable onto the machine that we're going to be running. But then we need to deploy the actual test cases. Okay. So that's the next step, is to deploy the test cases. Following on from that, we need to deploy an agent onto the machine so it can actually interact with the desktop and fire up the application that's under test.
So we've got some files there, they sort of JSON files, XML files or something like that are being transferred over in the test definitions?
In the deploy test step, yep, what we're doing is copying output from the build.
Right.
So the tests are effectively C# code,
okay,
that during the build step will be compiled into DLLs, test methods within those DLLs. So I'm using the MS test framework really to generate these tests. It's then a necessary step to put the agent on that machine, and you can specify your own version of the agent if you want, but here I'm just taking the latest and having that deployed down on a machine. The next step is to run those functional tests and report out the results of those, but then what I've actually got is a stop action on the Azure virtual machine. So after the tests have all run and have finished with the environment, we can close that environment down and actually incur no more costs. When we come into the second part, the system integration testing, the tests that we run there may be different. We may choose not to go against a test assembly. We may choose to go against a test plan. And for the test plan, we might choose the master test plan. And in that, we might choose to select the whole, okay, the whole plan, or we might choose individual parts of that plan. And that allows us to be able to determine, okay, we are going to run different tests at different stages in this pipeline. So in order to kick this off, what I'm actually going to do is make a change in code and commit that. So I'm going to start it right at the beginning. We'll just check that a build is running, and then we'll come back to it. So going back into Visual Studio, what we'll actually do is open up one of the tests, come into here, and we will make a simple textual change. And log in, okay, and we'll save that, and what we'll do is commit that change. Updated. So I'm just gonna check that in, make sure everything's okay with that, commit it. Now, of course, I need to sync that with the Git repository that's up on VSTS. So I'll just do a simple sync on that and just go and check that actually that build was kicked off okay, queued and in progress. So I'm going to let that run, and then we'll come back to this release pipeline and just make sure that that's actually been kicked off. So heading back to the slides.
So are you using your own agent, or are you queued that with the hosted agent?
I'm using the hosted agent with that.
And do you find that has everything on it that you need for testing, or do you install additional things as part of the release pipeline? Or
the hosted agent isn't actually where the build agent. Like I say, you could run some tests on there. as part of CI, but I treat the two things as very different. Build as CI and release as being the CD. And so I wouldn't be running much in the way of functional tests on the build agent, but certainly the test agent, we would necessarily have different.
So that's why you're firing up a virtual machine, starting a virtual machine in the release pipeline, and that's the virtual machine that the tests are being carried out on,
absolutely,
not on the agent.
Got yeah, you. And there are some hosted test agents that can be used, but certainly if we're talking about a legacy application in this particular case, where the agent needs to also be the application that's under test as well, the fat client needs to be on there. It just gives us greater control over that machine. We've done scenarios whereby actually we fired up not just a pre-existing Azure machine, but actually a whole environment being stood up from a template, and we know that works pretty well. But just for the purposes of today, I just put together a pre-existing Azure machine built from a template, but still just existing. So, does it make sense to automate all of the tests? And I guess the real answer to that is no. It never really makes sense to automate everything. There are different situations where it makes more sense, but actually, typically, we find that no is the answer. So the question is, if you're not going to run all of your tests, what is it that we're actually going to run? And we need to consider a lot of things here, like what's the technical architecture of the system under test, the test case quality, complexity, and volumes of test data as well. Because that will restrict us from actually being able to automate certain tests. To reuse and the reuse and the amount of functional change, how much churn is going on in the system? If there's no churn and you're not releasing to live, then absolutely the answer is no. Actually, almost don't automate at all. Just run it manually once and job's done. And also the business priority and risk. If they stand to lose a lot from getting things wrong, then actually you want to try and get as much or bake as much into that automation as possible. So what to automate? And I drop these into I call them buckets, but I label them with P0 through to P3. But build verification tests, these are very short running tests. These tests might actually run as part of CI.
Okay.
It depends how long they take to run. But this is really just making sure, is everything okay with that build? Could we possibly jump onto it and do some manual testing? Could we possibly run some more automated tests? And that's where we go for a second set of shorter tests as well, a smoke test. Now, in a smoke test, what I'm really looking for is something that checks, are all the pipes open? You know, all the major pieces of functionality, do they work? Are they not broken? Typically, I'd be looking for this to execute within the space of an hour. Let's somewhere between 15 minutes and an hour, but no more than an hour. Again, it's quite long running because it allows you to make some decision points earlier on the cycle. If you know, actually, the full suite of tests have got no chance of running because this whole piece of functionality over here is broken, then you might as well call a halt to it. So the smoke tests give you that kind of protection. Then the functional test, this is the full regression suite. This is the largest pool of tests. And these can take, and I have had this run in situations over the past, up to 17 hours. Now, there are ways and means, certainly with Azure and the infrastructure that's available to us, there's ways and means of being able to cut that down. If you've got something that takes 17 hours, then in theory, 17 machines should be able to do it in an hour. It's not like, you know, the situation of the man and the wife. It's not the case that 9 men and 1 woman can make a baby in 1 month. But actually, it's closer. It's actually closer in this situation that we can actually spread that load and use parallel running to be able to execute those tests together. Care has to be taken, though, because we don't want those tests running on independent machines bumping into the same data and causing conflict in there. So you have to be careful with what you're attacking in those functional tests. And then we've got the other stuff, the kind of nice to have stuff that you might look at the end, the low severity stuff. They may be easy to automate, but actually the return that you're going to get for them is not going to be particularly high. So just thinking about the tests in those buckets and where to focus the attention. Always start with P0. That if you only ever do that, that will still give you value. And P0 and P1 is actually going to give you a good indicator of quality. So also what to automate. Now I know this slide is really noisy and I'm not going to go through it in any great detail, but this just gives you another level of classification. I think these slides are going to be available offline, is that right?
I hope so. The whole session's recorded on Channel 9, so it will be available with that.
Okay, so this is just some different classifications of test cases and what sort of buckets they kind of fit into. And whether you should be considering to automate them. So I'm not going to go through that, but there is a thought process to go through here. But what about the importance of reliable tests? And I was talking to one of the guys earlier actually about reliable tests. You know, he was in a situation where a test could fail in the space of a week, could be failing five times, but then equally the next day it would pass. This is a real challenge, you know, getting reliable tests. So to increase levels of quality, we need to get those test cases reliable. Test failures are legitimate issues, or if they're not legitimate issues, i.e. they found a bug, then they're noise. And that noise can get so big, it can be overwhelming. And probably more so than that, it undermines trust. And when we go right back to that original thing, which is why do the stakeholders have this bad experience of testing? The number of organizations that I've been to that show me, oh look, we have these 200 tests, automated tests that execute. Oh, and there's these 200 failing tests that we don't really talk about. What is the point of having 200 failing tests? It's like, well, we haven't got around to working out what's really wrong with them. Sometimes they do pass, but we know that they're the failing tests, so we don't. But if you're reporting a 50% success rate to stakeholders, and you're fobbing them off with those kind of excuses, then it is going to undermine that trust. And that can be very damaging. So we need to deal with those tests. Test reliability is an important, and it should be. It's not always a visible measure. So having that 50% being actually shown somewhere on a dashboard is actually really, really important. And test reliability, not to be confused with success, because the two things are different. When test reliability gets up to around about 100%, then actually confidence starts. Yep. Not only your confidence as the test specialist, but also everybody, the stakeholders' confidence starts to increase when they understand that the tests are reliable.
Everyone likes to see lots of green lights.
They like to see lots of green lights. I mean, it is a difficult one because, you know, people do focus on green and they turn things green for the wrong reasons, or they don't go into enough depth with automated tests. They become perfunctory, really. It's like, well, we run this automated test, it clicks the submit button, we get a confirmation screen, happy days. Well, yeah, but did that record get written to the database? Did an email get sent to that person? Is their record put on a CSV file to be picked up by a letter run to actually be sent out in the post to them? All these things that the automation doesn't check, the detail, you know, that it goes down to. And there's cost with that, of course, but, you know, green is what people are striving for, but often becomes the enemy. So a few little tips on best practices for reliable tests, and I've tried to. There is a hidden slide in the deck actually, which has got all the detail behind this. But really, it shouldn't test. you know, we should be designing testability from the start. It shouldn't be an afterthought. Keep it simple means that actually these tests should be easy to author. They should be really easy to maintain. And the reason I say that is that very quickly, automated test code can exceed the code base of the application it's testing. And so you have an absolute maintenance nightmare. So they need to be maintainable. You need a very efficient way of being able to produce them and also update them. Deal with the lowest level. Unit tests are a perfect example of these. Go for those. They are low-hanging fruit that's really going to increase quality levels. It's the first. If I go into an organization that has no unit tests, it's the first thing that I recommend that they do. And I know that's doing me out of a job, you know, in terms of writing some test automation, but sometimes that is the thing that's really going to make the difference. Deterministic tests, well, they need to have a clear outcome, and sometimes that isn't very obvious when people write automation. I see the tests are actually difficult to understand why they're passing, but there's actually errors showing in the log, so they need to be clear about that. I think this is a key one for me, is that test code is just code as well. And people don't often apply the same levels of quality that they expect to the application under test to the test system itself. So, should we be doing peer reviews on automated tests?
Yes.
Absolutely. Do we? No. Sometimes it doesn't happen. Who tests the testers? And I think actually pairing a developer with a tester to look over their shoulder and say, what are you actually doing, is so important. A lot of people miss that step. So we have to be using version control, and we have to be using those good developer practices as well. Why not test against production deployments? If you can get your test data right, check that things are still working in production, and periodically just make sure things haven't fallen over. And quarantine those unreliable tests. Like I say, that organization that had 200 passing and 200 failing, let's quarantine them for a little while. Let's see if we can do something with them. And after a period of time, let's throw them away. If they're not being used, they're not useful. If it's too much effort to fix them, we should lose them. So let's get them out of the way and concentrate on growing that 200 into the next 300 and a better set of test cases. So, we've talked about it a bit, but test data in the pipeline. Now, it's fair to note that when we start this, we need to be clear about the fact that actually there are three different types of data that we deal with regularly. Configuration data. So this will be static data that's in the environment, customers that already existed in the database, and so on and so forth. You've got the expected data. These belong on the test case side, which is, this is what I expect to happen when we perform these actions. And then the input data, the data that we actually input whilst we're finding a customer and changing their account or whatever that might be. So we've got those three categories of data. And a successful automation approach requires that you have a good, repeatable set of test data. You need to ask yourself questions like, well, does that data get stale? Does it get old? Does it change, or does it expire? And that can cause us challenges, but knowing that that's the case allows us to work through that. And also, is that static data, for example, different in the different environments? It's always safer to store the test data, whether that be input or expected, generally, but also configuration data, could be baselines. But it's always safer, I find, to store those in side files and have the test cases refer to that side file, which allows you in the pipeline to change that data that's being used and for the test to still execute, but use different input data and different expected data. Popular approaches. I'll go through these. Now, Each of these does not represent a solution, I find. A combination of these actually represents a solution. So production copy, this is probably one of the most popular. The problem with this one is you can sometimes find that volume of data in there is huge, mahoosive, and also contains sensitive data, and sometimes we're not allowed to use that sensitive data. So it needs to be backwashed, and whilst that backwashing is happening, it needs to be sanitized and cleaned. So actually, the exercise becomes quite a difficult one. We want to get as close to that production-like data as possible. The test populate the data. Here what we're saying is that a test case will be responsible for its own data. It needs to insert records into the database, run its test, and then clear those down as if it was never there. The problem is here, the schemas can be so complex in those databases, and we mere mortal testers don't have the brain capacity to be able to understand some of those. But we start to see why testers need to get better and different skills as well. Tests select the required data. Now, the data already exists in the database, but we're going to select it. So we run queries again to say, find me a customer that's got an account balance of $50,000 or £50,000. And that can work really well, but again, care has to be taken that actually you're going to then change that account in some ways through the actions of that test, which might invalidate that data for the next test to come along. So you need to put safety measures in place to make sure that that data, if it does get burned, that actually other tests know not to use that data. And finally, a transaction reset. Now, I've not really found this working particularly well in many cases, but I have seen it in very small products, this works really well. But as soon as you get into solutions that integrate with third parties, it becomes really difficult. To reverse a transaction in database terms is quite simple. But if you've got a web service pointing to a third-party system that you've got no control over, how do you roll back an action that's happened there?
Understand, doesn't make sense.
Totally difficult. Choosing an approach with DevOps in mind. So thinking about that and thinking about the pipeline, this is just generally my approach, is what I do is try to automate a small thing, some test that's representative, and move it into one of the environments and run an automated test against it. Move it then to the next environment as quickly as you possibly can and rerun that test. If you find that your approach to test data is not appropriate, that you made in the first environment, then rework it. But you have to go and start back at the beginning of the pipeline again. So you need to rerun that test in system test, then take it to integration test, we're happy there, then move to pre-prod. Different problem here, we need to solve it a different way, change the approach to test data and come right back to the beginning again. And that's why I say take a small slither, because if you take a representative test, there's a good chance that actually you probably hit the right approach to test data through that. And so, before I move to conclusions, I'm just going to take a quick look at that build.
Hopefully the build's finished.
Hopefully the build is finished. So let's just minimize this and take a look over here. We do a quick refresh here, and hopefully that build has kicked off. Yeah, it kicked off a release 46. We can see if we go into that, we can see that it's sort of succeeded, but there are exceptions there. We can see some errors down here, and it's not actually gone into system integration test yet. And that the main reason for that is that there is an approval now waiting, and I can approve and reject that. And I wanted to show that because that's part of the workflow. But in order to make a decision as to whether I approve or reject this, I need to go into the test to see how those test cases ran. Now, what I'm actually seeing is a subset here. I'm actually only seeing the failed, but if I go to the failed and passed, what I can see is that I can have a look at the details of each one of those test cases. And if I come down to the failing one, what I can actually see here is that I've got an assert fail, assert R equal, expected, new member registered successfully, actual, new member registered successfully, exclamation point, as the Americans would say. But what we have is a discrepancy between those two text strings. So I can easily look at that and say, do you know what? I'd be very happy going live with just an extraneous exclamation mark. So
you're going to approve
that. At this point, I could go back and approve that particular build. and so I'm very glad that that worked out. that worked out well. But you can see there that the build actually ran into the release. I'm just very quickly going to hit on the conclusions. And excuse me. And so it is really about different skills. What we actually need here is the testers need to think differently to way they used to before. When we look at that release pipeline and setting up all those tasks, it's a different job that they're having to think about integrating with. And it's really important to understand continuous integration, continuous deployment, and the infrastructure that's required to be stood up through that. I'm going to finish off there and say thank you. I just do a quick plug there for one of our white papers, DevOps, the 5 ways that you can improve software quality, and there's a little link there. And like you say, those slides should be available, right?
Thank you very much, Danny. That was very interesting. I'm sure we'll watch that again online and digest it even deeper. Thank you very much. So we're going to take another 15-minute break. We'll be back at 2 p.m. when we've got Simon is joining us to talk about data and DevOps.